1 Corinthians 6:1 through 6:8, the 15th talk in a series on 1 Corinthians, was presented by Ron Julian on June 23, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're continuing in 1 Corinthians this morning. We will be right at the beginning of chapter 6. In our passage today, Paul seems to take kind of a sharp right turn from where he's been. He has been talking about the need for the church in Corinth to confront the man who is blatantly living in sexual immorality. And all of a sudden, he starts talking about how they shouldn't take each other to secular law courts, should handle it amongst themselves. Let me read you the passage that we're going to be talking about this morning, starting at the beginning of chapter 6. Does any of you dare, having a conflict with someone else, to go to law before the unrighteous and not before the saints? Or do you not know that the saints will judge the world? And if the world is to be judged by you, are you incompetent to handle insignificant disputes? Do you not know that we will judge angels, let alone matters of daily life? If therefore you have disputes concerning matters of daily life, do you give the power to judge to those with no standing in the church? I say this to your shame. Is it so that there is not one wise person among you who is able to judge between his brother, but rather brother goes to law with brother, and this before unbelievers? Actually, then, it is already a defeat for you that you have lawsuits with one another. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be defrauded? But instead, you yourselves wrong and defraud, and your brothers at that. Okay. Seems to me we have two problems to sort out here. First of all, how does this section fit with what Paul has just been talking about? And that may seem like the kind of an academic question, but that's always a very important question to address, because if a passage seems to be totally incoherent and out of place, there's a very good possibility that I haven't understood yet what it is that the author's getting at. So we want to at least take a good shot at trying to see, why is it has he all of a sudden started talking about lawsuits when the issue was dealing with the sexual immorality that was in the church? And then the second problem, of course, is what is it then that Paul is advocating? What is this about? We in this church, we haven't set up a church court. We don't have judges here to handle lawsuits among us. Should we? I mean, what's he getting at? What does Paul want of us in what he's saying here? And then I suppose I should say there's the third problem, and I don't know if I'll be able to solve that problem or not. I'm going to try. But the third problem is for us, I imagine you're in sort of in the spot that I am when you come to this passage. It's like, this is not the most exciting passage in the world. I mean, this is not the burning question on my mind, is where am I going to go when I have a lawsuit with one of you guys? Maybe this is a big issue brewing out here that I don't know about, but probably for most of us, this is not the thing that you've been worried about all week. So there is that final question of who cares? And we'll see how we do with that. Okay, let me see if I can make a couple of comments to put this passage in context. A couple of observations that I want to make. First of all, it seems to me that we have evidence here that Paul is not moving on to a totally new topic. He is in the middle of something. It's not clear how it's related, but there seems to be a line here, something that's tying this together. For instance, we notice here, we've basically got three parts to this argument. We have our section, which is in the middle, where he's talking about lawsuits. But in the previous part, And in the part immediately following, he talks about sexual immorality and gives a warning regarding that. In the first section, he starts out telling them to deal with this sexually immoral man who's living among them. And in the final section, he concludes with a defense of sexual virtue, basically a defense of the idea that there is a way that we ought to conduct ourselves sexually. So those things seem to fit pretty well. If that part in the middle wasn't there, it would be pretty easy to see how those two sections go together. And yet we do have that part in the middle, and we have to try to sort out what it's doing there. To make that even stronger, I notice that in the previous section we hear language like this. I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with sexually immoral people. By no means did I mean with the sexually immoral people or the covetous and greedy or with the idolaters of this world. But rather I was talking about any so-called brother, if he should be sexually immoral or covetous or an idolater or a slanderer or a drunkard or greedy. We have this list here that he mentions. Sexually immoral, covetous, idolater, slanderer, drunkard, greedy. Any so-called brother who is committed to these things as a way of life needs to be called to account, he's saying. Now, right after our little section here about the lawsuits, he says, "Or do you not know that the unrighteous shall not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived, neither the sexually immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor effeminate, nor homosexuals, nor thieves, nor the covetous, nor drunkards, nor slanderers, nor the greedy shall inherit the kingdom of God." It's the same list again, with a few more added in. Each time he goes to the list, he makes it a little bigger. But he was talking about this list of things here, and he talks about the list again here, and in the middle of it, we have the stuff about lawsuits. So there's some sort of an arc here. There's something that's tying all this together that we want to try to find. Earlier on, he warned that any so-called brother who is committed to a life characterized by these things needs to be called to account. And then in the final section, he says, "Don't be deceived. Anyone committed to a life of these kinds of evil will not inherit the kingdom of God." So the connection between ideas is pretty strong here, and it's not hard to see. But what the heck is this stuff about lawsuits doing in the middle of it? Okay, my second observation would be this. We have what seems to be the tie-in as we come into this section, this idea of judging insiders and outsiders. Paul ends the first section where he's warning about that they need to call this person to account. He ends it by saying, "You know that letter I wrote to you before, I didn't mean that you shouldn't associate with unbelievers. That's not what I meant. When I was talking about not associating with the sexually immoral and covetous and so on, I wasn't saying don't associate with unbelievers. What do I have to do with judging outsiders? Isn't it the case that you ought to judge those inside the church?" So, at the end of the section there, he brings up this topic. He says, "I wasn't talking about judging outsiders. I was talking about judging insiders." And then that leads right into this language about how they wouldn't dare to go to outside courts to judge conflicts inside the church. So, we're still, somehow, there's this tie-in, there's this connection in his mind between this idea of judging those inside and outside. Now we're talking about being judged by those inside or outside. So clearly in his mind, there's some sort of a bridge, some sort of a connection that has brought this up, although it's not necessarily totally transparent exactly what the connection is in his mind. But something is tying this together. There's something that has brought this to mind for him. Okay, my third observation would be this, and this is my attempt to sort of step back and get the big picture. I think that we can put all this together and reconcile all of these if we understand the fundamental perspective behind everything that Paul is saying here. He has a picture in mind. He has an issue that he's exploring with them. He's confronting the Corinthians with the implications of the gospel that they say they believe. In these real life situations, they're having to make some decisions about how they're going to respond, what they believe, what they think is important, what do they stand for, what does it mean to be a believer. We are gathered together here in the name of Christ, but what does that mean? What are we gathered together for? What is it that we believe? Can we take the name of Christ and make it an ever-expanding concept that can include any old thing in it? Or does it have specific content and meaning that we need to be jealous of? Do we need to say we're gathered in the name of this, and therefore this is not it? That's what Paul's saying. There's something specific about being a believer. A believer believes something specific. And the way you guys, you Corinthians, are conducting yourselves and the choices that you're making are not in keeping with the stuff that you say that you believe that you're coming together to be about. Well, what are some of these ideas that characterize the believer? There are a number of things, but some of the relevant things in this situation. As believers, we believe that God exists, that he has a certain character, that he is holy and righteous, and that the world around us is missing this. The world around us is not understanding that God is there and the nature of his character. We believe that sexuality is something that was created by God for a particular purpose. It is not just a means of gratifying myself physically. It has a role to play in the world. And we are trying to be obedient to God and learn what that role is. We believe that there is only one God. That's why Paul speaks here against idolatry. That God has called us to trust and follow him alone. Therefore, we're trying to learn not to idolize any other God or any other thing in the world. We believe that the wealth of this world is temporary and fleeting. And we are trying to pursue salvation first. Finding my citizenship in the kingdom of God is more important than getting more money. That's a part of the belief system that we have. We believe that we are evil people who need mercy from God. And so therefore we're trying to be merciful people ourselves. We recognize that if God were to give us justice, we would be lost. And we try to understand our relations with each other in that same light. Okay, so in short, to be a Christian believer is to embrace a way of looking at the world, a worldview that is different from most of the people around us. We are gathered together in the name of particular truths that characterize the message of Christ. Well, those particular truths make a difference, or they should make a difference, when we come to judge things in this world. And by judge, I don't mean condemn and be self-righteous. I mean to discern and recognize what's going on. The values that we bring, the picture of reality that we bring, ought to affect how we assess the situation. Well, the Corinthians seem to be, in these examples, trying to avoid judging each other. Well, that sounds like a good thing. Isn't not judging each other, isn't that what we're supposed to do? Jesus said, "Judge not, lest you be judged." Well, yeah, but that's not the kind of thing we're talking about. We're not talking about condemning each other. The Corinthians would be right if they were trying to avoid being self-righteous and condemning of other people. But that's not what I mean. What they were trying to avoid is the exercising the discernment to recognize when something fits the Christian worldview and when it doesn't. They were not interested in God's perspective on sexuality, for example. We're going to see that some more here in the next section that we'll start talking about next week. They had a place for sex in their lives. They didn't want God coming along and saying that it needed to be any different. It's also true that when it comes to this issue of when there are conflicts among them, they didn't want the Christian worldview to come along and tell them how they ought to reconcile this situation. If I'm having a financial battle with someone in the church, what do I want? I want to win, of course. I want to prevail. If I think you owe me money, what is the outcome that I'm looking for? I'm looking for my money. That's what the outcome is that I'm looking for. Well, how can I guarantee that I get that? I'll take them to court. I'll get the power of the state behind me. Maybe I can get the coercive power of the state to come in and make them give me my money. So, the basic theme, I think, that is tying all this together is the worldliness of the Corinthians. Their unwillingness to embrace a distinctively Christian view of life. That's the issue that Paul is addressing. And that's sexuality starts out to be the issue. We wander into this issue of the lawsuits and then back into sexuality. But the string that ties it all together is his concern over their unwillingness to use a Christian perspective on life to evaluate the situations in which they find themselves. Okay, now let's start looking at the specifics now. Let's get into the passage and see if I can explain how some of this works. He says, does any of you dare, having a conflict with someone else, to go to law before the unrighteous and not before the saints? Okay, this seems to come out of left field, as I said, but I think it arises from what he just got done saying. I didn't mean that you shouldn't associate with unbelievers. Isn't it true that you should judge the ones inside the church? Let God judge the ones outside? That idea of judging those inside and outside is what has given rise to this statement. Does any of you dare, having a conflict with someone else, to go to law before the unrighteous and not before the saints? Now let me see. It's difficult to say with great certainty exactly how Paul gets here, but I think it's something like this. I'm going to sort of give you what I think is his a broad paraphrase of what he's getting at here. Was I telling you to somehow pass judgment on unbelievers and refuse to have any dealings with them? No. After all, we shouldn't find it surprising that unbelievers do not live lives of trust and obedience to God. I mean, they don't believe. I can't call them to account for being inconsistent with their beliefs because they are consistent with their beliefs. What do I expect? They live the way that is in keeping with what it is they say they believe. But if someone among you is claiming to follow God and yet in fact is living in rebellion and is following the way of the world instead, that is something you need to address. As believers, you have a distinctive perspective from the rest of the world. Of course, the world is not going to follow your distinctively Christian way of life, but you should recognize, you should judge, you should discern whether your brothers are willing to do so, your so-called brothers. If someone says, I'm with you, I'm following Jesus, and yet they have set their heels, they've dug in their heels and insist that they will not follow the way of God in their life, then you need to make clear to them. You say you have come together with us, but the fact is you seem to be living in a way that suggests that you want to follow the world instead. You yourself have drawn the line and put yourself on the outside. That's why we must judge those inside. To be inside the church means to be a believer of the Christian worldview. We must continue to encourage each other to believe and to hold each other accountable to the truths of the gospel. The Christian perspective on life is like this. And if you want to be outside of it, okay, but let's call a spade a spade. You're outside of it. You're not you don't believe the things that Jesus has proclaimed and that Paul has proclaimed about what life is all about. Okay, now then, Paul says, to show you the appropriateness of judging those inside the church, let's turn the situation around. Suppose you are in need of someone to judge you. That is, you have a conflict with another believer, and you want someone to pass judgment on who is in the right. Would you dare to go to the unbelievers for such a judgment? They have an entirely different set of goals and priorities than we who follow Christ do. That set of beliefs that I talked about God existing and right and wrong and mercy and the relative unimportance of the material things of this life and the importance of my brother in Christ to me. How would I expect them to render a judgment that is in keeping with the values and beliefs that we as Christians hold dear? I think that's what's led into this, what he's saying. Look, this, in essence, the situation, the issue is the same. I was never intending to say before that you ought to pass judgment on those outside the church because they have made no claim to follow these truths. But you here, we here together, we are making that claim that we believe these things. We think these things are true and we want our lives to be about them. Therefore, it's appropriate that we, in our interaction with each other, conduct ourselves and make evaluations of situations around us based on those truths that unite us. Now, as I said before, it's not hard to understand why the worldly Corinthians would not be particularly interested in Paul's advice here. Because you take someone in the church and say, help us sort out this dispute, they might do something weird, like say, you know, I really think that you guys need to forgive each other. And I think what you need to do is just forget about the money. What do you mean, forget about the money? That doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's all well and good to come on Sunday morning and sing hymns and talk about how Jesus loves me and everything, but we're talking about money here. You're going to tell me that I'm going to let this guy get away with taking my money? That's not good. So, the thing that makes sense in that situation, let's take him to court. So, what Paul is saying here is, I think, is he's bringing in another example to show how our responsibility is to use the Christian worldview to judge and assess the situations that we find ourselves in as a group of believers. Is there sexual immorality happening among us? Someone is unrepentantly determined to disobey God in this area? Well, then what we believe as a community needs to be brought to bear on that. Are two people challenging each other and fighting over money or something like that? Well, again, if we're serious about this belief stuff, then the worldview that we have needs to be brought to bear on that situation. In both cases, it is not the world's perspectives that we're interested in. It is the perspective of God that we are trying to learn. Okay. He goes on to say something kind of weird. Or do you not know that the saints will judge the world? And if the world is to be judged by you, are you incompetent to handle insignificant disputes? Do you not know that we will judge angels, let alone matters of daily life? Okay, well, why does Paul bring this up? I've been thinking about this. I have to admit, I never used to be able to make much sense of this statement. When Jesus returns, we're going to judge the world. We're going to judge angels. And that means, therefore, that right now, we're competent to judge each other. That doesn't seem to follow necessarily. I mean, I don't even know what he's talking about exactly when he talks about how we're going to judge angels and that kind of stuff. But is he suggesting that somehow we've been supernaturally empowered to render accurate judgments about all situations or something? And we know that because we're going to be judging angels down the line. That doesn't seem right. I mean, that seems to be an overstatement of what it is he would be getting at. So what is he getting at? Well, I think it's something like this. I've been thinking a little bit about, actually quite a bit, about the relationship between our lives now and our expectation for the future. I mean, the Bible is full of exhortations that are based on our understanding of where we're headed. The promises of God, the hope of the gospel, tells us something about how we ought to look at things now. This is a very big theme in the Bible. Well, one of the things that's going on now is that we, as God's people, are in an educational process. It seems very apparent to me that the primary thing that God is doing in our lives as believers now is teaching us. We're walking by faith, in Paul's language. We're in a world where we don't see God, and we have people all around us who keep shouting in our ear that reality is a certain way. And yet, we are coming to understand that there is something more important, something else going on, that God is really there, that His values are important, that Jesus really did live and die and rise again. And He really is my Lord and Master, and He really does understand life, and it really is to Him that I should turn, and it really is that He will be king over God's kingdom forever, and that is where true life ultimately is to be found, and on and on. These are the things that we are coming to understand now, and we're living in a broken world in the light of new information. To use a biblical term, we are becoming wise. We are gaining perspective on life. We're seeing things the way they are. To the rest of the world, we seem to be gullible and naive and really missing the point. But the fact is, God is teaching us powerful lessons. We're coming closer and closer to reality, even as the world around us is getting farther and farther away from it. When Jesus comes back, we will be vindicated. We, in fact, were in the right. Now, I don't want to exaggerate this. We have been foolish and evil, and we have been in the wrong as individuals many times. I'm not saying we're going to be vindicated as everybody's going to see that I was a great guy and I never messed up. That's not true at all. But the fact is, that we who put our trust in Christ are going to be seen to have been right. We knew what was going on. Because we're so smart? No, not at all, by the grace of God. But the fact is, we were in the right. You look out at the stream, and the stream seems to be flowing this way, and yet there are those little spots, those little folks that seem to be swimming upstream and heading a different direction. That was us. And in the end, it's going to turn out this was the place to go. We were heading in the right direction. And so, somehow, in some sense, we can say that God's people will stand together with Christ, their head, and say to the rest of the world, "You went the wrong way." In some sense, we are going to judge the world. We have gained a perspective on things that makes us people with wisdom and perspective. We can see the way things are. Not perfectly, but we see something of the way things are. We will be with Christ, and He will say, "These were my people. Well done, good and faithful servant," and so on. I don't know what the deal is with the angels. I don't know what exactly it means that we're going to judge angels. I do get these little hints from the Bible that I think that we, as human beings, are really sort of the apple of God's eye, and that this training program that we're going through is actually giving us something that is more important even than what the angels have. The angels are messengers of God, and they understand some things, but the fact is, in the end, we are going to understand things better than they do, because we've been through the fire. We've seen something of what the struggle with sin is all about. So, I think what Paul is getting at is, look, we, the people of God now, are learning, we're gaining perspective. We are coming to understand the way things really are. The Christian worldview is the right worldview. It is the way the world really is. And so we are going to be the ones who in the end are going to judge the rest of the world. Well, if that's true, if it is this perspective that God is teaching us and giving to us in the gospel that makes us ultimately the ones who will stand with Christ and say to the rest of the world, you were in the wrong, then it is that perspective that we can use now. We have enough perspective on things to be able to bring it to the mundane issues of life, like who owes who what kind of money or that sort of thing. We have enough wisdom and perspective through what God is doing in the gospel with us to be able to see more clearly than any human court could what is at stake. What should we do in a situation like this? Now, I make a side comment. I don't know. It's probably true that you don't think of your struggles and suffering and difficulties in this life as marking you out as the apple of God's eye. But the fact is, I think that's the picture. This training course we're in is a great privilege. I know. I mean, I'm not being glib about this or pious about it. I understand. I mean, my life is hard often, and I don't go around going, oh boy, here comes more trouble. Glory be to God. I don't do that. But the fact is that ultimately it's true. God is not wasting our time here. He's not just sort of dangling us out over the pit and saying, someday I'm going to make things good for you, but I just want to watch you suffer for a while. The fact is that learning to follow the truth in a world of lies, having my eyes opened to what is good while I'm fighting off my own impulse for what is bad is an incredibly important educational experience. I think that's what the Bible teaches us. And that's what makes it true that we as people actually are learning. We're gaining perspective on things that gives us, the world around us doesn't think so, but it gives us perspective. That is worthwhile. It's in touch with the way things really are. So, that's what Paul's getting at here, I think. You're going to let secular courts sort things out between you? We are those who in our faith are learning the truth about life. What can some unbelieving judge tell you that you cannot see for yourselves even better? Aren't you believers? People who are learning things like the value of mercy and the relative unimportance of material possessions and the important place that my fellow believers have in my life. Isn't it true that one day these lessons will serve us to judge the rest of the world? So why are you letting the world judge you now? I think that's what he's saying. So then, he tells them, if therefore you have disputes concerning matters of daily life, do you give the power to judge to those with no standing in the church? I say this to your shame. Is it so that there is not one wise person among you who is able to judge between his brothers, but rather brother goes to law with brother, and this before unbelievers? There are some translation and interpretive issues in this little section that I'm not going to go into here, and I'll be happy to answer questions about them if you want. But I just want to mention a couple of things about the punchline here, what he tells them to do. First of all, there's a strong note of irony that I think we should pick up on here. The whole deal with the Corinthians so far has been their insistence on wisdom as the valuable commodity and their rejection of Paul because they didn't see him as being wise. And here's Paul saying to them, you guys are going to take each other to court because you couldn't find one wise person among you to help sort this stuff out? I mean, it's really kind of twisting the knife in a sense. Yeah, right. Tell me about your wisdom there, you guys. And secondly, I think we should notice that Paul's suggestion is a fairly simple one here. There really is not any talk of setting up a church court or, you know, let's appoint a set of judges to handle these issues. He's just saying, look, if you two can't sort it out, can't you find one wise person among you, one mature believer who can help you solve the problem? His advice to them is not going any farther than that. It doesn't need to be seen as going any farther than that. And I want to say something about that in a minute. Okay. His last comment on this, he says, actually then it is already a defeat for you that you have lawsuits with one another. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be defrauded? But instead, you yourselves wrong and defraud, and your brothers at that. Okay, this is a very important statement, but let's try to be clear first what I think he's not saying. We don't want to take this beyond what he intends. We run into the same problem with Jesus' teaching on turning the other cheek. It's basically a very similar idea. Are Jesus and Paul suggesting that it is virtuous to let injustice triumph? Is it that the righteous person will always lay down and let the ungodly stamp all over them? Is that in fact the virtue? I don't think so. The virtue is not just be passive and let evil run its course. The virtue is be loving. Seek the other person's good in what you do. So, we're talking about a situation where I'm having a conflict with a fellow believer. Why am I so quick to run off to the courts to make him pay, or whatever the issue might be? Maybe it would be better for him if I were to demonstrate my concern for him by freely letting go of my rights. Maybe it would be better for him for me to show how much importance I put on the fact that he and I supposedly share this set of beliefs and are headed for the same destiny. Maybe it would be better for me to say, I believe that I am in the right in this issue, but I care about you and I want to make peace between us, and so I'm going to let go. Now, is that always the right answer? Is it always the right thing to do that? I don't think so. When you put together a fully biblical picture of what we're trying to do, as I say, it's not just passivity, it is actively seeking the good of the other person. So maybe there are times, and I think there are times, when it's best for the other person for me to hold the line and make them be accountable for what they've done. It's not always the best thing to just let it go. But oftentimes it is the best thing to let it go. The reason that we don't see it as often as it is a good idea is because when you let go, you lose. It seems, it feels like you lose, and we don't want to lose. That's the basic principle that's tremendously important here. What Paul's saying is, let's look at the priority of things. First of all, you guys who are at odds with each other, what are your values? What are you all about? Why are you trying to win over the other person? Explain to me, what good are you pursuing in doing this? Explain to me why it wouldn't be better for you to just drop it. And then secondly, if you are going to try to resolve the situation, if you're not going to drop it, why turn to those who have the perspective that is least likely to be in line with the perspective that you share as believers? And his final comment makes it clear that he's upset in this situation because his expectation of the Corinthians is not just that they will not, they're not going to say, oh, it's okay, I'll drop it. And they're not going to let the wise man among them sort it out, because in fact, they are trying to wrong and defraud each other. They are actively seeking to screw the other guy. That's what this is about. I think Paul is pretty disgusted with the basic attitude that he sees among them, which is that when the Christian values, the ideas that are associated with the gospel are fine as long as they don't get in the way of anything that I want in this world. So, well, in what sense do you really believe this stuff if you only believe it when it doesn't get in your way? Okay, let me make a couple of quick concluding comments here. Is Paul arguing for some sort of ecclesiastical court system? I don't think so. I can't help thinking about the current problems in the Catholic Church when I think about this issue. I've been doing some reading about the problem with abuse that's happening with the priests in the Catholic Church. And there's a lot coming out now about that we really see in the Catholic Church, in the American Catholic Church in particular, the leadership there, the fruits of a great debate that started happening in the 60s and 70s in the church about, as you found, a new attitude towards sexuality happening in society. That new attitude found its way into the Catholic Church as well. And as a result of that, you have a number of people in leadership there who basically don't accept what I would see as the kind of sexual morality that Paul is arguing for in this very section in 1 Corinthians. And as a result of that, it has actually become true that some Catholic seminaries have become, it is not an exaggeration to say, they have become hotbeds of practicing gay priests. They go to gay bars, they sleep around with each other, and they abuse young men under their care. What happens when they get caught? Well, the guy, their superior, at first denies that anything's going on, until the family finally makes a big stink about it, at which case they pay them $1 million on the condition that they not tell anybody what happened, and then you take the priest and you move him to a different place. This is, in the Catholic Church, we have a strong, organized church government hierarchy. You have ruling bishops with great authority. But the problem is that a number of those authorities are not wise men. They don't share the perspective on life that the Bible talks about. They have abandoned the teaching on sexual morality that we find, say, in Paul. And obviously a court is only as good as its judges. So the problem is if we create this hierarchy in the church, let's set up courts and make each other the judges and so on. Now we have created an institution that we've got to fill with people, and what can happen very easily is the institution comes to be filled with people who are just as foolish as the institutions that are outside the church. It's not the presence of an institution that makes the difference. What Paul is calling the Corinthians to is to be Christian in their worldview. What he wants them to do is stop thinking like the rest of the world and think about each other as if the gospel were true. That's what he wants. If two believers are having trouble with each other, then they must ask themselves, do I want to win more than I want to follow God? If I am genuinely interested in growing in maturity as a believer, then let me turn to some of those who have maturity among my fellow believers and let them help us sort this out. You don't need to institutionalize a new justice system to replace the secular courts. You just need believers to think like believers, which is always a dynamic process. If we were to institutionalize some sort of a court system here, and some of us are established as judges, okay, that might even work out fine, might work out great for a while, but pretty soon the institution starts to become the reason you exist. Now somebody steps down, I don't want to be a judge anymore. Well, now we got to find another one. Maybe we don't have anybody who's necessarily qualified for that spot, but the problem is we've got the slot and we have to fill it. And so now we got to put somebody there, and before you know it, the structure, it's like that, they say that we shed all of our cells, that after a certain period of time, basically all the matter in me is, all of the stuff here has changed. It's not the same stuff that I had several years ago. The form is the same, but the things that make it up have all changed and become something else. It's kind of like that. The form exists. Choice. Is the gospel true, and am I going to live in the light of it? And then one last comment. I just think that Paul's argument here about judging angels is very interesting. Not because I know what it means to judge angels, because I don't know exactly what he's talking about. Nobody knows exactly what that's going to look like or what he's getting at. But can you imagine, what's interesting to me is, can you imagine yourself making an argument like this? You're talking to someone and you're trying to convince them of some perspective, and you say to them, don't you know that we're going to judge angels? I don't know anybody that talks like that. I don't know anybody that would try to make an argument on that basis. Well, Paul talks like that, and he makes those kinds of statements all the time. It's because he believes that the gospel is true, and the gospel is about, in large measure, the future. It is about where this is going. He has great confidence that Jesus is going to return, that God is going to judge the world, that God's people in the end will be vindicated and stand with Christ and enter into their inheritance. All of that is a part of his picture of what's going to happen. So he makes an argument like this because he expects the Corinthians to buy it. He expects them to be convinced by it, because after all, this is what's going to happen. This is where the future is taking us. It's like we make these kinds of arguments all the time in the mundane setting in the world. You get on a bus that's headed for the beach in the middle of summer, and somebody's there dressed in an overcoat and, snow gear. You might look at them and say, why are you dressed like that? This bus is headed for the beach. I mean, it makes sense. The way you're doing it doesn't make any sense, because that's not where this bus is going. I think you got on the wrong bus, or you've forgotten where we're headed or something. I mean, it makes sense to us in normal life to talk about, look, I know what the point of this is, so obviously you've missed it, haven't you? Well, that's what Paul's getting at. We know what the point of this is. We know where this is headed. So, you Corinthians, the way you're conducting yourselves and thinking about this stuff, it doesn't make any sense. You're dressed in snow gear and this bus is going to the beach. I mean, it doesn't fit. So you have to make this choice. Get off the bus and get on another bus that's going up to the snow, if that's where you want to go, or else figure out what this is about and live accordingly. Most of the time, Paul's arguments, Jesus' arguments for that matter, about how we ought to live now, are grounded in their assertion about where this is going. So I just think that's very important for us to remember, that in the end, if I don't have a picture that this is headed somewhere and that makes a difference about where I am now, then I haven't understood reality the way God does. Okay, so let's take a few minutes. We have a few minutes anyway for some questions or comments.
So you're seeing a lot of this as a reality check rather than a call to action or a specific action?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's right. In fact, it's hard to know how much of this is actually going on. It seems to be that it is happening. I mean, it's hard to get around the fact that he seems to have in mind that this sort of thing is happening. But the reason he's raised it in the first place is to come at this angle of what sort of judgment should we use? What should we think about being in the church, being outside the church, and what it means to be a follower of Christ? Who has the discernment to recognize what that ought to be about? We do, if we in fact have understood the gospel and its implications. So, yeah, his concern is that they abandon their worldly evaluation of things, which has been from the beginning in this letter. I mean, they're elevating Apollos over Paul was because they had this worldly set of values that Paul was not a wise and impressive person. And now, when it comes to this stuff, they have a worldly attitude towards sexuality, they have a worldly attitude towards, I gotta make sure that I get my slice of the cash, when it comes to disputes among them. I mean, in all of it, they're driven by desire for worldly success, worldly acceptance, the pleasures of this life, all of that stuff. Those are the things that are the non-negotiables for them, and they've kind of painted this Christian stuff over the top of it. And Paul's saying, it doesn't work. You gotta make the choice. Up here.
The thing he said about Paul talking about judging angels, I appreciate learning about Paul and what he said and Jesus said and digging into it deeper, because I was thinking how I've heard people from different walks of life and religions and different things make comments in different ways. It's like just looking at things from the perspective of this group about how we think the future is going to look or something, mm-hmm. and saying things that really make me uncomfortable, like, well, we know we're going to be raptured up here or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, or different things, and can be way off base. So I get a little uncomfortable to talk about how we're going to be judging angels.
Right, yes. No, I know what you mean. But it seems to me pretty consistently the case when it comes to teaching about the future in the Bible that the concern is to tell us what the goal of the future is. It doesn't at all surprise me that Paul would make this allusion to judging angels that really is not spelled out very clearly anywhere in the Bible, and that I don't know the specifics of what that means. And, you know, we can imagine a Christian group growing up that, you know, we've decided exactly what it means to judge angels. We're the, you know, we're the first church of the angel judgers or something like that, you know, and we don't let anybody in who thinks that you judge angels on Thursdays, because we know that you have to judge angels on Saturdays, which was the original Sabbath, and, you know, and on and on. There is this thing that happens to us where we get preoccupied with those things that are interesting to us. You know, oh, when's it going to happen, and who's the Antichrist, and how does this stuff happen? The Bible tells us a lot about the future in the sense that it tells us that Jesus is returning, that there is a consummation to history, that my fulfillment is to be found in His return. I am to put all my hope in what my life will be when He returns to establish His kingdom and so on. But then the closer you try to look at the details about, so how exactly does this work? I'm not saying there's anything wrong with trying to assess those things, but I'm with you. I do get nervous when we get so preoccupied with trying to nail down those details and nail each other based on whether you got the details right or not. There is a kind of preoccupation with the future that is not what the Bible is getting at, I think. Now, I don't want to say the wrong thing. I believe in studying the prophets and, you know, the Olivet Discourse and the things that the Bible says about the future. If Jesus said something about what was going to happen, it behooves us to try to understand what He was saying. But it also is appropriate for us to recognize that those are difficult questions. And in the end, the point that He was really trying to make had to do with our expectation of the purpose of history and the goal of our lives and so on. And if Jesus ends up sneaking in a way that we weren't expecting, which seems likely to me, it's the way He came the first time. I mean, nobody really knew what was going on there. So I fully expect that Jesus is going to return right when there's this huge prophecy conference where everyone's decided, aha, we know when he's coming. He's coming next year. And he'll be there right then. That's the way I think it's going to work, but it's hard to say. Don't quote me on that. No, in fact, do quote me on that, and anyone who doesn't believe that can't belong to this church.
Jim Turhan, Ron.
Hi, Jim.
I was just looking and just thinking about some of the wider context in the book of Corinthians as we're looking at this too. Paul in chapter 2 is talking about, I'll just go to verse 4, and my speech and my preaching was not with enticing words of man's wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and power. And it talks about, verse 14, but the natural man receives not the things of the Spirit of God, for their foolishness unto him, neither can he know them, because they're spiritually discerned. 15, but he that is spiritual judges all things, yet he himself is judged of no man. 16, for who hath known the mind of the Lord, that he may instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ. So, just to reinforce this whole idea, we really shouldn't be going outside the church to make any kind of judgment. I have no, dead people outside the church can't make any kind of judgment for living people inside the church. And they wouldn't understand if we go to 1 Corinthians 13 and all about love, as you were saying before, the bottom line is everything else, even faith, you know, doesn't hold anything unless we can love. And I guess my comment would be too that even though there will be situations that maybe we should hold the line with our brothers and sisters, if we're loving first, and that may take some great wisdom, but if you aren't clear which way to go is to don't defraud your brother in any way when you just don't know it's clear. Just love first.
Right. If I mean, that's a good emphasis there. If in fact it is ever the case that it would be appropriate for me to hold someone to accountable or not forgive a debt or something like that, as you say, the priority, the prior issue is I have to be clear in my mind that that what I am pursuing is love. I am pursuing their interests. And that's the hard thing. When I am at enmity with someone, the last thing I have on my mind is their interests. I'm very well aware of my own. But that is in fact the thing that we're pursuing, is that I am following a God who is trying to teach me that the welfare of the other guy is as important as my own. Not that my welfare is not important. My welfare is important to God, but so is his. And that's more important than whether I win a lawsuit by any means. Yeah, that's good.
Just one last thing that you've brought up to me very well is that a lot of First Corinthians is about judging. It's not just in that chapter, but it's really a lot.
Yes.
Through a lot of places.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, I think we'll stop there. Thank you. We'll pick up next time. Next week, we're going to start into the next...